the snowmobiles end run around Adirondack motor vehicle regulation. This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. We welcome John Warren, founder and editor of the New York Almanac, a site that many of us visit for news on the history of New York and interesting happenings in New York State. John Warren is on the staff of the New York State Writers Institute. He lives in the Adirondack Park. He's co-founder of Adirondack Atlas, a geolocation database and mapping service company, and his weekly Adirondack Outdoors Conditions Report airs across northern New York on North Country Public Radio. John recently posted an article on New York Almanac called How the Adirondack Forest Preserve Was Motorized. Can you walk us through what happened? People weren't thinking about motorization, were they, when the Adirondack Forest Preserve was created back in 1885?
They certainly weren't. They were, you know, in 1885, when the Forest Preserve was created, there was no motor vehicles. And it wasn't until about the 1920s or so that motor vehicles really began to invade the Adirondacks and the Adirondack Park. So the park, which was created in the 1890s, was around for about 30 years before any kind of motorized vehicles really began to be used extensively in the park.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the arrival of motor vehicles mean the arrival of a lot of visitors, or kind of a flood of visitors?
Yes. Well, the flood began as a trickle. At the beginning, in 1900, there was only about 8,000 automobiles registered in the United States. But people did have an interest in getting out into the woods. But by 1929, there was 23 million automobiles owned by one in five Americans. So the idea that you could get into the family car and drive into the wilderness, basically, or into the wildlands of northern New York, really took off then, beginning around in the mid 1920s. And at the same time, there was a interest in motor camping. You know, there was about 5 million auto campers, they were called, in the early 1920s, and more than three times that many by the end of the decade. Before the Great Depression, they say about 10 to 15% of Americans were auto campers. So it was fairly popular. Perhaps even, I guess, more popular than today by percentage.
Really? You mean the equivalent, or the 1920s equivalent of a coach or a trailer that you pull with your pickup truck?
Right, or modified vehicles, or small trailers, or just loading all of your stuff into the back of the sedan and heading out.
In those days, I mean, how did you get into the woods? I mean, were there roads?
Yes. Well, in the 1930s, there was the Civilian Conservation Corps program, and they built a lot of roads. But even before that, the program that program was based on was a New York program. FDR, of course, brought it from his governorship of New York to the federal government as the Civilian Conservation Corps. But there was a state program before that, and they put people to work building lots of roads in the Adirondacks, mostly for fire suppression, but also access. And they built in 1920, they built at least three of the big campgrounds, Sacandaga and the one in North Hudson, Sharp's Bridge, I think it's called. And also the one at Cascade, in the Cascade Lakes, which is now a picnic area, but was at the time one of the first campgrounds. So those were flooded. The one in Sacandaga particularly became very popular and filled up in the first years. By 1923, there was 1,500 people a day in that Sacandaga River campground in Northville.
And was there controversy about this, or people said, hey, this is great, you know, having people visit the North Woods?
A lot of these roads were built as truck trails or fire roads. And they were built 10 feet wide, 2 foot shoulders. They were layered with crushed stone and gravel. And they're very, very similar to some of the bigger snowmobile trails that are being built today, for example. The Adirondack Mountain Club, the Association for the Protection of the Adirondacks, and other groups, they opposed these roads in the 1930s. And basically, D.C. got an attorney general's decision, which said that they could continue to build these roads, but not for the public. Of course, later on, those roads became... Some of them were closed. Others were actually open to the public. So, you know, examples like the road to Marcy Dam, for example, and other roads became snowmobile trails and so on. So it was an odd situation. But DEC really was one of the major, and when I say DEC, I mean the predecessor of DEC, the Conservation Department, was really the major builder of roads in the backcountry of the Adirondacks. In addition to the logging companies, of course.
And the people have their auto campers and whatnot. They're going into the woods. Was that doing damage or doing damage in the opinion of a number of people that thought it wasn't a good idea?
Well, a lot of, after World War II, four-wheel drive vehicles became more popular. Jeeps, I'm sure people remember doodlebugs and tote goats. And they really could take on these trails, these old roads that had been built by the Conservation Department. And even then, they weren't even that old, though, 15 years old, but still being updated. So that really allowed people to get much deeper into the forest, where before, you might go and stay at one of the state campgrounds, but to actually drive into a road, say, into the high peaks, was not really possible. Once these roads were built, of course, you could drive well into the high peaks, and then you could get out there and in general, I think the DEC, there's a mileage. It's about 3 to 5 miles. Once you get beyond 3 miles from a road on the trail, you tend to not see people as often. So, just the ability for people to get beyond 3 miles on foot, that's about the limit of what most people want to do. Now, of course, lots of people go much farther, but in reality, most people don't go much farther than 3 miles. Well, it turns out that most of the Adirondack Park is within 3 miles of a road. Almost the entire Adirondack Park is within 3 miles of a public or private road, which is something people don't really realize. So this is what happened in the 1930s, basically. Much of this happened in the 1930s. And the results of the road building, and also the opening of those roads to snowmobiles and the public, later on in the 1940s, 50s, 60s.
One Conservation Department commissioner that you write about named Harold Wilm, who I believe you're saying he served from 1959 to 1966, he was kind of friendly to Jeeps, dirt bikes, and these new creations, snowmobiles.
Wilm wanted hunters to be able to access deep into the woods. And he opened roads that would go to hunting areas or yarding areas where white-tailed deer are yarded up in the winter. And this turned out to be not a good plan for the deer, of course. And eventually the Department of Environmental Conservation reined this in much later. But in the 1950s and 60s, he really wanted as many truck trails and other options into the forest preserve as possible. So rather than the forever wild, the forest preserve is protected by the state constitution's forever wild clause. And it's supposed to remain forever wild. But Wilm saw, truck trails and motorized equipment in the on the lakes and in the forest preserve itself as perfectly fine with meeting a forever wild standard. Mm-hmm. So he really encouraged a lot. It's another case where the Conservation Department really spent a lot of their time encouraging sort of the misuse of this forest preserve through their policies that opened many roads, especially in the early 1960s. A lot of those roads eventually, at the time, the snowmobiles were only just coming around. the earlier snowmobiles that made that were popular were from 1961 or so, and by 1963, 65, snowmobiles started to become popular, but not really in the Adirondack so much as the farmland outside of the park. But then around the mid-60s, that's when snowmobiles began to began to use a lot of those roads, and today, you know, lots of trails are on old roads that are either closed or have remained open. A good example is the road through is the roads in the Moose River Plains. The road through straight through the Moose River Plains, the main road that goes from Indian Lake to Inlet, is open to snowmobiles in the winter. That's a main. That's sort of a main road. You can almost make an argument for keeping that open, and because it connects the two communities more directly, although it takes a lot longer to drive that road because it's a rough dirt road. But they also then, of course, now that snowmobile that remains open as a snowmobile trail through the winter, but then it also branches off from that road. So there's others, you know, stretches out into different parts of the Moose River Plains. The Moose River Plains, of course, is a wild forest area. So the state allows motorized access to wild forest areas. That's a part of what happened as a result of all this discussion over whether or not, you know, motor vehicles were, you know, should be a part of the forest preserve or not. There are even wilderness areas which the state allows snowmobile trails on within a certain alongside the roads of the wilderness areas, so they kind of keep them out of the center. But they but they are basically allowed anywhere in the Adirondack Park. So there's recently been some lawsuits. One of the things the state DEC wants to do now is to expand the snowmobile network, which is already very extensive, over 3,000 miles of snowmobile trails in the Adirondacks, mostly on private land. But the state wants to build faster, bigger trails that connect hamlets around the region. And of course, and that's the cause of recent court cases and really a transition in the way we think about the forest preserve and its purpose.
And do snowmobiles have to travel on a trail, or can't they just go on other flat ground?
Initially, Commissioner Wilm, he allowed snowmobiles to just drive anywhere into the forest preserve. And snowmobiles can, for the most part, go anywhere within certain bounds. I mean, once the snow gets too deep, they become a problem. But they, you know, they're when I was a kid, I used to race snowmobiles when I was a kid, and we had trails. We had trails that there were trails across farmers' fields and so on. And down near where you are, I'm sure this is still the case. Most of the trails are along farmers' fields, and you can go quite the distance just by riding from field to field. Mm-hmm. And of course, they eventually those trails were more formalized. So some farmers didn't want snowmobilers on their trails, and other farmers wanted. One of the trails marked and so on. So those trails gradually became marked and organized, and then you know that of course the snowmobile companies inspired a lot of those snowmobile clubs, a lot of snowmobile clubs in the 1960s, particularly to build and establish trails to places they might want to go, like a local lake or someplace else. So. They also provided money for trail building and also provided big grooming equipment, which would make the snowmobile trails much wider and easier to manage. So, you know, the old trails were not as easy to ride. You had to have some experience snowmobiling before you just went cross country on a snowmobile. The trails today are groomed with massive groomers. And they're 10, 12 feet wide, some of them, and they're really rather easy to drive on. And of course, that also means that they are driven on a lot faster. So a lot of older snowmobilers complain about the speed of folks on trails today because they do travel at high rates of speed because the snowmobiles go faster, and the trails are much smoother mm-hmm. and wider. So these are all contributing factors. So one of the first organizations to really build snowmobiles, to really build snowmobile trails in the Adirondacks was the DEC. They actually built snowmobile trails to, some across Forest Preserve and all across Forest Preserve, I'm sorry, because state land, all state land in the Adirondack Park is Forest Preserve land. And then the second organization was the town of Webb. And the town of Webb and Inlet, which still has a massive snowmobile system built mostly on private land, but mm-hmm. using town funds and some state money and club volunteers, they built a large network there. They charge for that network. So outside mm-hmm. of the town of Webb and Inlet, the trail network is free. That is maintained by local clubs. Sort of coordinated by the state. Many of those trails actually run across Forest Preserve. In the town of Webb, they don't so much. They're almost all on private land because that was just easier to do. I think I got off your question there a little bit.
No, that's all right. Well, I mean, let me ask you about pro and con. I mean, so a lot of snowmobiles, a lot of snowmobilers, let's say starting in the mid-60s, from the point of view, and this is my understanding of some of the tensions, if you will, in the Adirondacks. From the point of view of the people who live there, some might see this as a positive, something that keeps the economy going to some extent. These snowmobilers eventually stop, and they maybe go to a tavern or an eatery of some kind and spend some money.
This is a sort of a standard argument, and it's used by all recreationists in the Adirondack Park. So, hikers will tell you that they are the people who keep the park, going, and snowmobilers will tell you that if it wasn't for them, everybody would starve here in the Adirondacks. And boaters and anglers, they all make these same arguments. But the truth is, of course, that the Adirondack Park, most people in the Adirondack Park work in two sectors. They work in the public sector. So first of all, there's only about 200,000? I want to say 200,000 people in the Adirondack, full-time people in the Adirondack Park. Most people work in either the public sector, okay, which would be teachers, highway departments, the conservation mm-hmm. folks, DEC, for example. And then there's also the tourism sector, which is a part. But most people actually work in the public sector. So they work for, the school districts, the hospitals, the those kinds of places. Now the tourism is in itself very segregated in different ways. So, for example, down in Old Forge, They do have a substantial boost from snowmobiling. Of course, snowmobiling, only lasts at best over the last 20 years or so. Snowmobiling in most of the Adirondack Park has been limited to not more than 6 weeks on average, for sure. Probably more like 4 weeks on average. Some years there is literally no snowmobiling because there's no snow. And then other years, there's some limited snowmobiling. Now, that's on average across the whole Adirondacks. There are a couple of snow pockets which get snow from the Great Lakes. So out by Old Forge is one of them. So Herkimer, Lewis, from the Tug Hill Plateau to Hamilton County, northern Hamilton County, tends to get more snow than any place else in the Adirondacks. And those areas, they can have more. Their average is probably 6 weeks, and maybe some of them in the far west 8 weeks. But in general, they're not really. That's not a long time. That doesn't compare. There's a number of studies. Essex County does a great study. The Essex County Tourism Organization, ROOST, they have mm-hmm. recently done a study of their whole region, which includes Hamilton and Herkimer counties or Hamilton County and Franklin County. They've made it clear that the big tourism driver are not hikers, not necessarily snowmobilers, but people in their cars who want to drive to someplace in the Adirondacks. They want to drive around, and they want to see things. And they do some hiking, and we've seen a lot of big increase in hiking lately. So there, you know, a number of those people are hiking. A lot of them are boating on Lake George and Lake Champlain and the big lakes. Really, most lakes are motorized. So there's a lot of factors is my point here. And while you know there are lobby organizations. Well, there's one lobby organization, New York State Snowmobile Association, and they will come out every couple of years with a new study about millions pumped into the economy and so on. And you know, they pump money into the economy. There's no doubt about it. But when you put that in perspective, compared to all the other factors that make up the economy, you know, what people actually do for a living, what are the wages on these jobs that that snowmobilers provide? They're very low. They're not a school teacher's wage. They're a waiter's, wage in a snowmobile, restaurant out west somewhere. So, right. And it also, of course, doesn't apply to the whole park. It only applies to segments of the park. So there's a lot of vocal, hey, we want snowmobiles. They're great for our economy and all that stuff. And some places, and there certainly are some businesses who rely solely on snowmobiling. Of course, there are some businesses that rely solely on parasailing in the summer for, 12 weeks every summer, or 14 or 16 weeks every summer. So that doesn't necessarily have a large impact across the park.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there any movement now or campaign now, or is there some kind of call for action in your piece? But what kind of public policy should there be about the snowmobiles and the other motorized vehicles?
Well, I think, there really are solutions here. And one of them is to move snowmobile trails to private lands. Most snowmobile trails are, in fact, already on private lands. But there are substantial mileage, about 800 miles, DEC says, which is a disputable number. I mean, it could be as many as 1,200 or, But about 800, at least 800 miles on forest preserve land, forever wild forest preserve land. Now those trails should be rerouted. Now the problem, of course, is that you want to go from Newcomb, where there are very few people living, and you want to go to Indian Lake, or you want to go to Minerva, these places where also there have small population, and they have a few businesses open. Not many. Newcomb has one or two at the most. I think one only in the winter. What happens is they want to be able to put these trails across forest preserve land to connect these communities, when in fact there's really not much reason to connect those communities. I mean, people can ride, between Minerva and Indian Lake in other ways, and they can ride between Newcomb, and the rest of the world other ways.
Right.
But one of the solutions, I think, is to just transition these trails to private lands, like most snowmobile trails already are. And snowmobilers have special rules. So owners of snowmobile lands are exempted from insurance, and they get special legislative category that allows them to allow people to use, allows snowmobilers to use their land without any impact on them. In other words, if the snowmobile gets hurt on their land, they can't turn around and sue the landowner. That's one of the solutions, is A, move them to private lands. Another solution, of course, is happening naturally, and that's the global warming. Global warming is eliminating, slowly but surely, the snowmobiling industry. Now, recently, there's been a bit of an uptick. Snowmobiling industry follows closely with the overall economy, of course. When people have more money, they can buy luxury items like snowmobiles. But what most people don't realize, though, is those snowmobiles cost about $13,000 on average. And so they're for a new snowmobile. Now, most snowmobiles are bought used for that reason. there's been a decline in snowmobiling since the 1970s. In about 1972 or so was about the peak snowmobile production in America. And ever since that period, they have gone into decline. They were very popular at that moment. They were on worldwide sports, snowmobile races, and, you know, all kinds of, you know, stunts and things were happening. And there were races on lakes all around America, that you know, all around the North Country anyway, on weekends. And you know, it was a fad. And that fad, and they overproduced snowmobiles, and eventually the snowmobile companies went from, there were 100 different makers of snowmobiles in like 1972, and by 1979, there were like four. So the snowmobilers in general have been in decline. Now, there has been some pickups. In the 1990s in the Adirondacks, a lot of snowmobile trails, dare I say most, certainly in my area, most, had fallen into disuse and were no longer being used by snowmobiles. And a number of new snowmobile clubs were formed at that time to rejuvenate those trails.
I'll just squeeze this in. For years, I've wanted to thank you, because when I was starting doing the historians in 2014, you told me, gave me the best advice I got. He said, you got to call it Historians Podcast. And I have, and that's become our marketing strategy. So thank you, John.
Oh, you're welcome. I love the program, Bob, and I'm so glad that we've connected, and I look forward to more great things from it.
We're closing with an interview with John Warren that was done in 2015 at the American Revolution and the Mohawk Valley Conference at Arkell Museum in Canajoharie, sponsored by Fort Plain Museum. In 2015, John Warren's online publication was called New York History Blog. It has since become New York Almanac.
I try to go to as many as I can. I live in the Adirondack, so it's sometimes a stretch to get, but to come down here to the Mohawk Valley is, you know, just a treat. It's a great drive.
Yeah, and this is really great. I mean, you know, being kind of a local person, I live around here. I think they've done a wonderful job.
I think it's really a great thing when historians come together to talk about their local area and their region, and you know, I hope that this kind of thing can be replicated, you know, around the state. That'd be something I would look forward to.
Yeah, on the New York History Blog, there's been quite a bit of chatter about that, doing programs like this. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of folks in different regions who are beginning to organize their historians locally and meeting regularly. And some, of course, have met regularly for a long time, but a lot haven't. And there's really a lot of more movement on in the local history front.
Tell us about the New York History Blog. What is it?
Well, it's a daily news website about the history community, historic preservation, historic sites, and advocacy, and we have a variety of writers. About 30 different people probably chime in over the course of a month to contribute from areas where they, you know, that they're familiar with. Plus, we have a lot of announcements at conferences and events and exhibits. It's really a lot of latest news every day. We try to be a place where historians can land, you know, and keep up to date on what's going on.
That's John Warren, recorded in 2015. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.